Hi, welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm Kurt Cahoon of Greenway Partners. In our series on innovation in the environment, we are profiling people and projects that make a difference to environmental change and progress in our community. Joining me today is Andrew Whitney, an economic development specialist for the County of Humboldt. Andrew, thank you for joining me.
Hey, Kurt. Good to talk to you.
All right. Well, so I've asked you to join us on the show today because I know about your personal background a little bit, and I want to get a take on what it is you do at the county and why economic development is pertinent to environmental protection and environmental conservation in this county.
Okay, great. Well, yeah, I met you back at HSU, and we were both working on a master's program. My subject was brownfields and the redevelopment potential for those brownfields. And that led to me getting some grant funding and eventually getting a job here at the county.
So what is a brownfield? It's a strange term to people
who
don't know it.
Basically, there's the EPA definition, which is the U.S. EPA. And they define a brownfield as real property where the expansion, redevelopment, or reuse of that property is complicated or may be complicated by the potential presence of a hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant. So in our area, that could mean a lot of different things. It could be something as simple as a former gas station property that had a leaky tank, or it could be something like a sawmill that is no longer being used for lumber milling that may have more serious chemical contamination issues.
Okay, and so it's something that's preventing us from reusing or redeveloping a site for putting a site back to better use. And I'm wondering, generally, as you said, you did an inventory of brownfields as part of your master's project at Humboldt State. What are the numbers? How many brownfield sites do we have in the county?
If you use the broad EPA definition, there's literally hundreds, because the EPA defines it as real or perceived contamination.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of leaves the door open for a lot of sites that may not really have any serious contamination issues but can be considered brownfields. And they could just be idled or vacant or underutilized sites that have an industrial history to them, which might cause them to be less desirable for development.
And if you look at it from the perspective of a developer or an investor or a bank, any uncertainty about contamination on a site is going to make somebody hesitate.
Yes, that's true. There's ways that property buyers can protect themselves, but it may be an added step that they don't want to pursue when they're looking to start a project that's going to be expensive and time-consuming. So, often developers will look for, what we call greenfields, which are undeveloped properties with no development history, as a site for their developments. Now, the thing that you stand to lose there is, you've got these other properties which have a past and have been used, which could be reused as a sort of a restoration project. But, it does have uncertainty and expense. So,
right. And greenfields being a site that hasn't been developed yet, and as a community, as a general plan process, we're trying to protect open space. We're trying to protect what we have as open space, keep our farmlands in farmlands, and not lose more of the things that we want in a community: open space, farmland, access to nature, recreation. We want to keep those things. We don't want to lose those things to development and sprawl. So redeveloping what's already been developed, I think, is a key thing that we should be supporting.
Oh, I fully agree with you, Kirk. That's kind of what drew me into this subject, was the potential to have economic development occur while preserving our agricultural and resource lands, which I've been all over the country and I've never seen a place that grows trees like we do up here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a shame, in my opinion, to give up on the forest lands or even the ag lands when you have vacant, idled properties sitting unused. So
right. Well, and let's talk a little bit about your personal background. So you came to Humboldt State for graduate school, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah.
From where?
Well, kind of all over. I've traveled, spent time in Washington State and Southern California, Central California. I was an organic farmer, actually, in the Northeast for probably about 5 or 6 years, running a 5-acre vegetable operation outside of Buffalo, New York, for a couple seasons, and then eventually drifted into construction. And did that for probably about a decade, and then decided I wanted to take another step and kind of live up to my ideals, which was, environmental restoration with an economic development, approach.
Right.
Like you were saying.
Yeah. So it's a difficult thing for those of us that love buildings and love architecture and love the fact that when you build something, build a building or you build a center or a theater or whatever it is that you're constructing, you're putting a significant impact on something. And if you do it right, that impact is going to be there for indefinitely, maybe 100 or more years. And so you want to do it right. And when I first learned about what brownfields are and redevelopment, it just struck me as, wow, the perfect salve for my guilt about liking buildings.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, well, there's a problem with this site. It's already been damaged. It's already polluted. We're going to clean it up and we're going to build something on there that's going to benefit, you know, the community or the developer, whoever it is, but it's going to be something that's going to benefit the community long term.
Yeah, it definitely stands to be a potential win-win situation. So.
Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about the types of pollution, especially in this area, that people would see. And you mentioned legacy wastes from sawmills. What may be some of the contaminants that would come from a sawmill historically?
You know, pretty much every large sawmill operation would have a tank of fuel, if not several, to either power equipment or generators or, you know, logging equipment. So that's probably the most common thing that you'll see is a leaking underground storage tank.
Okay.
And that makes up probably the bulk of the regional water quality control board cases in the county. And there's also a county local oversight program that has information on all these leaking tanks, historic leaking tanks. So that's a big one, and that's primarily petroleum products.
So diesel and oil and things like that.
Yeah, diesel and oil, and you know the gasoline too. The gasoline is more problematic than diesel because it's more mobile, the water horizon.
No pun intended. Different spelling of mobile.
Right. So, but then, you know, you get into some of the other compounds, which historically were used for wood preservatives. A fir mill, you know, the redwood mills didn't need the preservatives, but the fir mills would spray wood life, or basically a pentachlorophenol substance, on the freshly milled lumber to prevent black mold from growing on it.
When it was installed in a building or something, it would turn moldy? Is that the idea?
Well, yeah, it would mold while it was curing.
Oh, okay.
So in other words, it would come off the green chain, which is, you know, fresh green lumber, and then it would typically get either sprayed or dunked with a preservative, which was a potentially messy operation. And at the time, they maybe didn't realize that pentachlorophenol is a very persistent chemical in the environment and, you know, poses hazards. It's basically a dioxin precursor. So, you know, we've heard a lot about dioxins probably.
Yeah.
And pentachlorophenol is a dioxin precursor. And so that one is seen on sites around the county. And also just the burning of materials actually generates a certain amount of dioxin. So, you know, our TP burners and things like that have the potential to create hot spots of dioxin.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, treated wood, if it's burned, will create a lot more dioxin than, you know, plain wood.
Redwood that's been burned. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, I first came to Humboldt County in the first time I remember coming, I should say, it was like 1971 or two. And I had an aunt and uncle that lived here, and I was young at that time, but they lived Lower California Street in Arcata. And literally the bottoms were a sea of smoke coming out of dozens of teepee burners out in the bottoms at all these little lumber mills. And people that haven't lived in Arcata for that long might be somewhat surprised to hear that Arcata, until probably 1971 or two, had a sign on the entrance to town that said the lumber capital of the world. And there were dozens and dozens and dozens of lumber mills in and around Arcata and Eureka that were milling, as you suggested, redwood and then fir, you know, lumber. And it's a surprising thing. If you look at the bottoms now, there's here and there little pieces of that legacy that you can still see buried under brush or maybe where an old building is. But the legacy of these things continues to haunt us, the groundwater pollution and the exposure to human health and the environment that we might still see. So what are some strategies for cleaning these things up? I mean, you can't dig up everything and put it all in a landfill somewhere. That has its own costs and association.
Yeah, it's a challenging issue because you get into debates about how clean is clean enough and what level of harm reduction, you know, should we achieve. And I think that's kind of a sticky, many people would like to see it clean as before we got here.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, that's going to typically be cost prohibitive. You know, up here, we don't have a lot of high-value redevelopment projects like you may down in the Bay Area.
What would those be an example of, like a stadium or something? What do you mean by
high-value?
Well,
a stadium or a Pixar corporate corporate headquarters or, you know, something like that, where you have a very high-value corporate tenant that wants to move into an area like Pleasanton, California.
Mm-hmm.
They've done a lot of redevelopment, brownfield redevelopment there, but they've got multi-million dollar development projects to kind of bankroll the cleanup process. So we don't see that up here so much. I mean, we have a proposal for the balloon track or track and some other projects that are occurring slowly, you know, especially with the recession and things. There's not a lot of projects. Without the projects, the cleanups typically don't occur because there's not this giant funding source to get it, you know, 100% cleaned up.
Right.
In lieu of a project.
Yeah, and then the other thing that you mentioned earlier is that because we're not constrained by the fact that the only project sites we have left are brownfields, so therefore let's clean them up and put new projects on them, we still have developable land that hasn't been used before in our area, so people would obviously migrate to that first, perhaps.
Yeah.
So what do you think from a policy perspective, if you could wave your magic wand, what would be some ways to incentivize and induce people to reuse brownfields in ways that they're not now?
Well, after looking at the issue for years, I've found that a lot of the constraints on brownfield properties aren't necessarily related to the contamination on the property itself. It can often be an infrastructure constraint. In other words, the infrastructure needed for a sawmill is maybe not adequate for a mixed-use diversified development project that would need wastewater, water, and other infrastructure. So that's something that I've definitely seen. And also, a lot of our sites are located in the coastal zone.
Right.
Clustered around Humboldt Bay,
right.
Which getting a project through the coastal zone permitting is pretty difficult, especially if you're advocating for a change of use in the property. So that can almost be as expensive as cleaning up the contamination and just trying to adaptively reuse a property that's not going to be used for the same purpose it was historically used for.
Right.
But I think it has to happen on its own time. I think I'm not going to comment on the political hot potato of the general plan update, but I will generally say I favor preserving agricultural and resource lands here in the county.
Yeah.
and advocate reusing properties that have brownfield properties. But I think that kind of has to come from the public.
Yeah.
You know, it's not my role as a county employee to tell the folks here in the county what we should be doing with our land.
Right. Despite what you may read in the newspapers, that is.
Yeah.
It's not always the case that the county employees want to ruin the world for everyone else. I understand that issue. You know, and so when I first learned of brownfields, one of the things that struck me was the person who owns the property is responsible for cleanup, generally, despite the fact they may not have been the polluter, which to me seems like an obvious conflict if you're trying to get people to buy properties and put them back to higher and better use. So if you buy a property, as you mentioned earlier, not knowing anything about its past history, as many sites have the appearance of being vacant and have never had any action on them, and all of a sudden you buy the property and lo and behold, there's an old cleanup order or there's, you know, something like that that could exist on that property. Does that constrain people's decision-making when they go to develop, do you think?
Well, I think education can go a long way in removing that particular obstacle. Back in 2002, a federal law was passed, which basically clarified liability for cleanups. And under that law, if you do a phase one investigation, and it's basically a phase one investigation is a sort of a codified investigation of the contamination status of a property done by a registered professional. So if you do a phase one site investigation, you are cleared of some of that potential liability. In other words, if it comes back clean during the phase one investigation, but then you go to dig your foundation and you find something that no one knew about,
right,
then you won't be liable for that cleanup cost. Now, you may not be able to do your project, but at least you won't be on the hook for whatever that mess is that you found.
And who would be?
Well, it would be the prior owner.
Okay, but you'd have some legal, I imagine, legal challenge to file against that prior owner, and there would be a process there to determine responsibility?
Yep, there would be a process, and it would take time, and it might be difficult, or, you know.
Yeah.
I've never actually seen that process occur.
Okay, so, I mean, that seems to me a fairly significant constraint to our goal of keeping people away from developing greenfields and keeping them into brownfields. So what might be another way to look at brownfields projects? You know, can you give us an example, some favorite projects that you know about maybe in this area and out of this area? You mentioned a few in the Bay Area that you know about.
Well, there was the Arcata Recycling Center is one that I'm familiar with out on the Samoa Peninsula, and that one's kind of a, not really a sad story, but it's, I think I read in the paper that they're closing that facility.
Yeah.
It was a recycling resource recovery facility out on the Samoa Peninsula that was built after a brownfield assessment was performed on the property. It's the old Samoa mill out there.
Mm-hmm.
There really wasn't any contamination associated with that part of the property, but, you know, it is part of a larger mill redevelopment project. So that was a good thing initially. It created some jobs, and I think maybe that's the subject of a different show, what happened with that.
That is a whole other topic.
Yeah.
But yeah, while you're on the topic, there is something interesting to me about all these large mills that have just recently shut down. You know, Simpson plant shut down mid-90s, and just in the last 2 years, I think the final throes of the old Louisiana Pacific pulp mill has finally coughed its last breath and is now kind of sitting there vacant. And so what the hell can we do for a site like that? What can we do?
Well, I understand that the owners are currently salvaging whatever equipment they can out of there. I don't know what their long-term plans are, but, you know, it is a good question. What do you do with these large sites? The ones on the Samoa Peninsula, there's hundreds and hundreds of acres of land out there which potentially are available for development, except for the fact that, you know, there may be contamination, but I don't think that's going to be the ultimate hurdle. I think there's other issues like the coastal zone permitting, tsunami concerns, and sea level rise, you know, ultimately,
right
out there,
right,
that might cause an investor to be hesitant about putting a lot of money into that project. You know, some of these sites, the best thing may be to just get rid of the eyesores and let them go back to being habitat.
Yeah. And then again, we talk about the fact that most cleanup efforts are driven by a redevelopment project. Let's talk about the ones that aren't being driven by a redevelopment project. There are sites that need to be cleaned up, irregardless of their future potential as development sites. How do we possibly imagine cleaning these sites up with no money and no incentive? And, you know, it just seems like we're kind of sitting here going to be waiting a long time.
Yeah, you know, and natural remediation is it's a real thing. And it's going to, unfortunately, I think that's going to be what happens to some of these sites. You know, you're definitely familiar with Indian Island.
Yes.
That's kind of a topic we first met over.
Right.
There you've got, you know, an island that's pretty close to sea level. You know, the Wiat tribe is working on cleaning that site up, but it's challenged by many different factors, including archaeological resources and basically grave sites in the area that they're trying to clean up. And they can't really develop the site. So, yeah, they've just been kind of chipping away at it. We were able to get them a little more funding to finalize their dioxin cap out there this fall. But they've got a lot of work left to do, and it's unclear where the money is going to come from.
This is the Eco News Report. I'm your host, Kirk Cahoon of Greenway Partners, and joining me today is Andrew Whitney, an economic development specialist for the County of Humboldt. And we've been talking about brownfields redevelopment and a few other things that are of interest for us as environmental conservation advocates. So, Andrew, let's switch gears a little bit and actually talk about the loss of, or I should say the potential loss of redevelopment agencies in the state and exactly what is going on there.
Okay, well, the County of Humboldt does not have a redevelopment agency. We looked at establishing one probably about 5 or 6 years ago, and the Board of Supervisors opted not to establish a redevelopment agency, which, as it turns out, may have been
the right call.
Wise decision
right.
Based on the fact that the governor and the state government is basically trying to claw back some of these redevelopment funds. I can back up a little and
yeah, what is a redevelopment
concept
agency?
A little bit.
Yeah, that'd be great. What is a redevelopment agency? How does it work?
A redevelopment agency is a governmental agency that's established at the local level after the adoption of a plan in a prescribed area. So every redevelopment agency has a geographic area that they are targeting based on the fact that the area has been determined to be blighted, which means basically run down.
And that's probably a sensitive designation to get to.
Yeah, that was a...
Some people don't want to be known as living in a blighted area, and they would take offense to that, probably.
You know, they did when we tried to get one going in the county. I'll tell you what, we heard from all sorts of people that didn't like that.
Right.
Again and again, and that may be why we didn't have one. But, you know, I think, you know, the redevelopment's been around since the 70s, and what it does is it establishes an area, creates an agency, and it captures tax increment, which tax increment is the amount that a property tax increases in that given area.
Based on some of the work that the county would be doing to improve the area, is that the idea?
Well, that and, you know, just general, the sale of property. You know, basically everyone that owns property pays property taxes. In California, it only goes up 1% a year unless you do improvements on your property or sell it.
Good old Prop 13 right there.
Yep, all Prop right. 13. So,
okay. But you're borrowing basically against future improvements in tax base.
That's it. Exactly.
Okay. So that has been used widely as a tool for, the reason I asked this question is it's been widely used as a tool for improving, cleaning up brownfield sites, redeveloping brownfield sites, especially in urban areas. So if the county is not participating in that program based on what you guys decided 5 years ago, the state and many levels of the state, many local governments, including Arcata and Eureka, have been actively working as redevelopment agencies as well, and they're now stuck with trying to figure out how to plug the holes of no financing and no funding.
Yeah, and I think we saw some kind of last-minute Hail Mary passes in a couple of local jurisdictions where they're doing their best to spend that redevelopment money before it got taken back. And, you know, the city of Arcata has some brownfield redevelopment projects going on, and you know, they've done a lot to kind of lock up those redevelopment assets.
But redevelopment agencies have been used not only for brownfields redevelopment, but for, not controversially, I think, for affordable housing development. But the controversy has stemmed from perceived giveaways to developers and building things like sports stadiums for sports teams or restoring a theater in Oakland. I know that became a bit of a topic. But
yeah.
But generally, these redevelopment funds have been used almost exclusively for the development of affordable housing and redevelopment.
There's, you know, the state redevelopment law required that 20% of all tax increment be allocated to affordable housing. So it was a great source for the development of affordable housing. But like you said, there's also been some somewhat controversial projects, and, you know, some might see it as a corporate giveaway in some ways, because if you go to certain areas of California that have redevelopment, you'll see kind of cookie-cutter corporate developments with hotels and conference centers and things like that, which, you know, may not be everyone's idea of a good sustainable development project. So.
Right. Well, in the last few minutes that we have here, I want to ask you specifically about affordable housing and where is the need for affordable housing in this community? What do you see?
Well, you know, I think we need rental housing. It's hard to permit in the county right now because it's unpopular in a lot of areas. People don't want to see rental housing in their neighborhoods if it's a single-family neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So the county definitely has a shortage of land zoned for multifamily.
So that would be low-income rentals, in other words?
Yeah, apartments for any level of income, really.
Okay.
Not necessarily low-income, but even senior housing or things like that. We, you know, we do our best to create these opportunities, but again, if the public doesn't want this kind of thing, it becomes a political tug of war. So,
yeah,
I think more multifamily housing would be good to increase the affordability for people. But I think also we're seeing, you know, with the recession, real estate is becoming more affordable again, which for people that haven't bought yet is a good thing potentially. Right. So, you know, I think it's a combination, but definitely some more rentals, particularly for the lowest income folks. You know, the folks you see on the street, very hard to help, but there's obviously a need there. So,
you know, there seems to have been a kind of a deviation away from the old traditional model was people that are on the street need to get sober and get off drugs, and then we can find housing for them, maybe. And what I've noticed lately in affordable housing circles, I've participated in some discussions and groups and meetings, is that, you know, in the national level, the trend is more towards people need housing first, because one of the things that you're going to be able to do is you're going to be able to offer people housing. You're going to get them off the street, out of the weather, in a place where they can actually get stabilized and then address some of these bigger issues, this, you know, the alcohol and drugs and the mental illness and things like that. But trying to do those things without housing seems really impossible.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. You know, I think it is hard to offer, you know, a nice opportunity like a apartment to somebody that's obviously in the throes of an addiction, but pretty much the only hope for them is to stabilize one part of their life until hopefully they can address the other issues. And you know, the other alternative is to wait until they get sick enough and they end up at the hospital, which is very costly for our society. So,
yeah, there's actually a New Yorker article about Million Dollar Murray in New York City that came out 2 or 3 years ago, and was a person who'd been on the street and was addicted and had some mental illness issues, and had basically over the course of 9 or 10 months cost the taxpayers of the city of New York $1 million in ambulance trips to the ER, police response and fire response, because he was perceived to have been dead 7 or 8 times. So, you know, housing one person is going to be significantly cheaper than $1 million over the course of a year. It's going to be a magnitude of order less expensive.
That is true. And, you know, my girlfriend is a nurse at St. Joe's, and it's kind of discouraging to realize how many people are utilizing a hospital bed as their, you know, prime housing opportunity, you know, when they're too sick to live on the streets.
Yeah.
It's tough to see that for everybody.
Right. Well, one of the other issues that, you know, we talk about as environmental advocates or people that are interested in conserving our local natural resources and doing protection as well in certain places, these issues of infrastructure, so brownfields redevelopment, affordable housing, these all have huge impacts on how our community develops, which obviously has huge impacts on the environmental and social fabric of our area. So these two areas that you're working in, I think, are really key parts of protecting our environment and steering us away from developing sprawling communities. So what are your suggestions as we go forward into the next year, looking at how to support you in these endeavors?
Well, you know, I would just encourage the public to get educated on the issues. If they can understand what the relationship between land use planning and environmental preservation is, and then potentially they can express that to the elected officials, which obviously represent the public and make the decisions. You know, this is a big year coming up for the Humboldt County General Plan.
Right.
Very contentious, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't speak up, then no one knows what you're thinking. So,
and it almost seems in many cases that like the most, let's say, the people that are the loudest are the ones getting all of the attention. And there's a lot of people that are sitting in the background not really understanding all of the issues and kind of just deciding they're not that affected by these things. But in fact, we're all affected by the way these policies are being drafted and how these thoughts are being played out.
Yeah, you know, it's really true. So I think just listening to your show is a good way for people to get some knowledge on these topics and listen to what other people in the community are saying and kind of make your decision and feel free to let your decision makers know, whether that's at the city level or the county level or even in a community, you know, like McKinleyville, there's planning processes that occur and decisions that are made that do affect, you know, the future of our community. So,
and I know as a public servant, you love meetings, but there are those of us that hate meetings and can't imagine going to a meeting after work. And you, I know if you thrive on them, and everyone in your office thrives on meetings after hours. You guys all love those. So,
yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today as a discussion regarding brownfields redevelopment and affordable housing. And we've been speaking with Andrew Whitney, a economic development specialist for the County of Humboldt. Thank you for joining me today, Andrew.
Hey, thanks, Locker.
You bet.
Yep, bye.
Thanks. This has been the EcoNews Report. My name is Kirk Cahoon of Greenway Partners, and I've been your host for the past half hour. I was speaking with Andrew Whitney, Economic Development Specialist from the County of Humboldt. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again at the KHSU website under archived programs at khsu.org. The EcoNews Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU and KHSR for the EcoNews Report.